I don't see it as this sort of, you know, ultimate definition of ourselves, which is part of the narrative that I think really messes with mothers particularly. I mean, I think there's this idea that, you know, your life isn't realized until you've had children. And then secondly, once you have children, you're going to become this pristine, sanitized version of yourself. And that if you buy enough of the right products and read enough of the right books, you're going to be able to categorize and manage parenthood in this really organized, contained way. And that just wasn't my experience. My experience was I'm the same asshole now that I was before. And I'm the same, you know, I've got the same flaws. I'm the same. I've got the same interests. I wasn't erased when I became a mother. I don't find it infinitely fulfilling. And I wasn't brushed into this pristine version of myself to do this this supposedly, you know, incredibly central, most important job in the world. And that was why I started writing, because it wasn't my experience. And I started wondering if, you know, the rest of the parenting world was crazy or I was. You know, I was like, one of us is definitely lying, right? Like, mm-hmm. One of us is full of shit. And if it's me, that's okay, but I want to know. Yeah. So I started writing to disrupt, but really just to discover if there were other parents who felt like I did, who felt this sense of, you know, deep devotion, obviously, and gratitude for your family, but uh-huh. also feeling like, you know, is this really all there is? And why do I suck at this so badly if I care this much, you know, type thing.
I'm Srini Rao, and this is the Unmistakable Creative Podcast, where you get a window into the stories and insights of the most innovative and creative minds who've started movements, built thriving businesses, written best-selling books, and created insanely interesting art. For more, check out our 500-episode archive at unmistakablecreative.com. Janelle, welcome to the Unmistakable Creative. Thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you, Srini. It's good to be here. Good to be back.
Well, you are one of a handful of guests who has had more than two appearances on The Unmistakable Creative, and for good reason. Funny enough, I remember the first time I stumbled across your writing, I was like, I don't read mom blogs, but I can't stop reading this. And I realized, I was like, okay, this is not a mom blog. This is something far more interesting.
Thank you.
So I want to start by asking you, what did your parents do for a living? And what impact did that end up having on the direction that you have taken with your life and your career?
That's a really great question. That's a really good question. My dad worked. So my grandmother started she was the first female editor of the University of Washington newspaper in the 50s. And then when she graduated, she bought and edited local newspapers. So she started in an unincorporated country town out in way in Northern California in Lake County. And so by the time I was born, my dad and my mom both worked with her at the newspaper. And when my parents divorced, my dad stayed on at my grandmother's newspapers, different one, but same type of deal, local journalism. And my mom was this sort of hustling renegade, entrepreneur, single mother, taking care of her two children, but refusing to go into like a cubicle job or something that would take her away. She was fiercely insistent on her own independence, despite being a single mother and very poor. And so she started her own little travel magazine in Central California and kind of hustled with that. And then but she'd get all these side jobs. She'd do these like junkets to Reno for gamblers. And she worked at a knife store in the mall for a while. And as unnerving as that was as a child to sort of watch her and wonder if she was going to succeed or wonder if it was going to work or, you know, how the electricity bill was going to get paid some months, I really learned from her more than anything this idea that if you want something, you just go do it, even if it doesn't make a lot of sense, and that you really can define your own life in terms of how you make money. And there's a huge risk involved in that. and that it may not be for everyone. And there will definitely be terrifying moments of how the hell are we going to pay this bill? But it was the freedom that she had that really resonated with me and stayed with me. The sense of you just go out and do your best to do it, no matter how sort of little sense it makes. If it means that much to you to define your economic life in those terms, and I'm not trying to say that, you know, everyone should go out and do that or can. I mean, I understand people who are working jobs they hate to survive. That's not what I'm saying. But she was just unwilling to do that for better or worse. And that taught me a lot about the role of that risk taking and just carving your own way despite what society defines for you.
Mm-hmm. How do you develop a tolerance for risk and make a path of your own choosing despite sort of having deeply embedded social programming that is based on what society defines for you?
Well, I mean, to be quite honest with you, the only reason I can do it is because I have a partner. I mean, I have four children, right? Yeah. I mean, I couldn't do this. I couldn't have made a lot of the choices I made as a writer if he weren't there. Just because, you know, four kids, we can't, what are we going to do? You know, I mean, uh-huh. You've got to keep a head over there, you know, keep a roof over their heads and keep food in their stomachs. But in terms of beyond that, how I've been willing to accept the risk of, you know, I quit my job. I quit teaching to pursue writing, which really didn't make a lot of sense in the economic context of my life. And it was a big risk. I mean, but the way I managed that was simply that I think that sometimes you have to just pull the plug to have the courage to do it. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
Let's think we all want to see the path before we take the step, you know, like, okay, I want to see my next job. I hate my current job. I know that it's bullshit. I know my life is, you know, I hate what I'm doing, but I need to see where I'm going next in order to leave what I'm currently doing. And I think sometimes we have to just pull the plug and leap and trust that we're going to figure it out because frankly, we're going to have no choice. Mm-hmm. and that was sort of what I did.
Yeah.
Just because I think sometimes it's just we can spend our whole lives sitting and waiting for the path to materialize. And it often doesn't until that fire of necessity is underneath us. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely does. You know, it's interesting that you brought up, you know, sort of having the you know, parents involved in journalism of all things and a newspaper, which I think makes for sort of an interesting conversation given our current media environment and how polarizing and divisive it has become because we have different versions of the truth based on the media that we consume.
Exactly.
And I think that to me, one of the things that's fascinating about your work is that you're challenging sort of the cultural narrative of parenting. Mm-hmm. And so one, what is the sort of standard media narrative of parenting and what prompted you to challenge it?
Well, I think what I've observed, the standard narrative, particularly as associated with mothers, but and maybe it's the same with dads, although I think it is hyper, you know, it's concentrated on this, on motherhood, is this idea that, I mean, first of all, that having children is this really sort of sanctimonious, ultimately meaningful activity, which, you know, I'll probably get killed for saying this, but I'm not sure I fully buy into that. I mean, I think that having children is as rewarding as any other life activity in terms of if you really want it, you know, and if you find value and meaningfulness in that. But I don't see it as this sort of, you know, ultimate definition of ourselves, which is part of the narrative that I think really messes with mothers particularly. I mean, I think there's this idea that, you know, your life isn't realized until you've had children. And then secondly, once you have children, you're going to become this pristine, sanitized version of yourself. And that if you buy enough of the right products and read enough of the right books, you're going to be able to categorize and manage parenthood in this really organized, contained way. And that just wasn't my experience. My experience was I'm the same asshole now that I was before. And I'm the same, you know, I've got the same flaws. I've got the same interests. I wasn't erased when I became a mother. I don't find it infinitely fulfilling. And I wasn't brushed into this pristine version of myself to do this, this supposedly, incredibly central, most important job in the world. And that was why I started writing, because it wasn't my experience. And I started wondering if, the rest of the parenting world was crazy or I was. I was like, one of us is definitely lying, right? Like, mm-hmm. One of us is full of shit. And if it's me, that's okay, but I want to know. Yeah. So I started writing to disrupt, but really just to discover if there were other parents who felt like I did, who felt this sense of, deep devotion, obviously, and gratitude for your family, but uh-huh. also feeling like, is this really all there is? And why do I suck at this so badly if I care this much, type thing.
Do you think that having been exposed to journalism at such an early age, from having seen your grandmother and your parents, has had an impact on this?
Yes, because my parents were always interested in discovering the truth of something more than they were sort of the tribal sides, right? So it was less about right and left, the politics, and more about what's the truth? How do we use some critical thinking to sift through this and discover what's actually going on? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Which I think is one of the things we're seeing right now, is that people aren't even looking at, I feel like there's a very limited desire on both sides, really, to examine, what's true, what's false, what's adding up, what's fake, and even if it disrupts or doesn't align with what you already believe, like this sort of devotion, dedication to discovering the truth, whether or not it aligns with what you want it to be, what you have already decided it to be, mm-hmm. That sort of just research and journalistic way of looking at the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you say that. A couple of nights ago, I was watching this documentary on Vice, Vice News, and they do some really interesting documentaries, my HBO, and they were actually, it was a documentary about a border town in Arizona. And I got to see a side of this story about, putting up a border wall or protecting the border from a side that I've never seen it from before, from people who are very much in support of this idea. And, for the longest time, I thought this idea is nonsense. It's completely insane. But when I saw the story of, by the way, our borders are being overrun by people who are bringing in drugs, literally, and the thing is that you've got very minimal border guard protection. It's like, okay, you've got an army of drug cartel people and a small border guard. What are you going to do in that situation? And I don't agree with the notion of building a wall at all, mm-hmm. but I suddenly had a much deeper understanding of why these people feel the way that they do.
Exactly. And it's uncomfortable, right?
Yeah, it's totally uncomfortable. I mean, I'm Indian. So for a minority to say, okay, I understand why these, initially I wrote them all off as just racist lunatics. But now when I got to see some of the downsides of what they're struggling with, I was like, okay, I don't agree with the point of view, but I understand it now.
Exactly. And I think that that's really, really hard for people. I mean, it's hard for me, and it's hard for everyone to go, because we construct this us versus them mentality, and to have to really examine why are these things in existence beyond, that person is wrong, or mm-hmm. that person's just this or that, in these sort of broad brushstrokes. I think it's really difficult.
Yeah.
And, but I don't think we're going to make any progress until we start really looking at, where did this stuff come from? I mean, none of this stuff that we're facing right now was developed in a vacuum. I mean, it just pop up one day. I mean, this is years in the making. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I get in a lot of trouble too. There's a section in my book where I talk about, I live next, briefly, I address this sort of elitism in certain liberal circles, this sort of very wealthy, elitist, disconnected perspective. And some of my friends said, gosh, you're doing a reading in this town and you totally talk about
you know, you make fun of this. And I said, well, yeah, because it's bullshit. Like, I mean, I'm on the left too, but I can also recognize that we've got problems. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. But it's like, it seems like we're not allowed to say, you know, well, we're not really allowed to look at the problems on our side, you know, air quotes.
Uh-huh. I remember that section of the book, specifically you've sort of comparing yourself to a mom who seemed sort of, you know, to fit the mold of the perfect mom who participates in all the activities and all of that. And I remember that part of the book struck me so much, because it was, you know, it was comparing, you know, your story to this very picture perfect story.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of that, that sort of disconnect that I'm trying to address is, you know, this sort of polish that we put on, mothers, particularly, I think, mm-hmm. sort of veneer to be perfect and to be, sort of aligned politically in a certain way. And everything just becomes, I think it just becomes a little too oversimplified for me, I guess, is mm-hmm. the point.
So we're talking about truth here, and this is really kind of an interesting conversation to me. It's something that's been on my mind a lot, because both of us in a lot of ways are media creators, and every one of us has the opportunity to create media. We all do to some degree, even with something as simple as what we choose to put in our Facebook status updates. And as somebody who creates media, I think we have, you know, an incredible responsibility, and also we hold something very delicate in our hands, because people often will make decisions based on, you know, what they consume. Mm-hmm. How do you see us getting back to a place of truth in such a polarizing media environment as somebody who creates media that, for, you know, better or worse, is actually quite polarizing?
Phew. Dang, that's a big question. I mean, I think it will take the collapse of what we're doing now. I mean, and I think we're getting there. I mean, I don't know if you saw recently, there was some graphic shown about the right. It was the sort of bar graph that showed the far right and then the far left and then the population that was sort of in the middle between them, and how far left and how far right were the extremists. And over the last 30 years, you can see those two, far right and the far left, the two bars just getting further and further away, and the centrist part getting smaller, you know, the shared values and the people that sort of crossed in between. And I think as we observe this disaster, I think we're going to have to go somewhere from it. And I don't think we're going to have a choice but to start listening both to what the other side is saying and the critiques of our side, right? Mm-hmm. Like to look at our own, the lies that we tell ourselves. But I think that people speaking honestly, maybe less attacking and name calling, mm-hmm. if we could imagine such a thing, and a little more speaking from personal experience, from your place in the world. I mean, I don't know. Yeah. That's kind of why I try to function in a place of just speaking from where I stand and not assuming the position assuming I understand other people's positions.
Definitely.
Just because I think as people model more and more of that, of the self analysis, you know uh-huh. what I'm saying? Like the looking inward and going, okay, why is it that I see it this way? What narratives have I consumed? You know, where am I being rather tribalistic in my thinking? And that sort of modeling of the internal work of what lies am I telling myself that have allowed me to align so fully with this extremist perspective and the refusal to understand other perspectives. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'm not super hopeful. I want to be more hopeful, but I trust, but I was looking at, but I think art is one of the things that does that for us, man. I mean, I just spent a few days in Chicago with my husband on book tour, and I was down at the Institute of Art in Chicago, and I went down to the basement and they had this whole photography and film installation of mostly the civil rights time in Chicago, and it was just incredible. I mean, it just brought tears to your eyes to watch, you know, the activism and the art that's created in that mess. And I think that art is largely how we get there, you know, how we get to that place where we're looking inward and we're seeing truths that we don't want to see, maybe because it isn't quite so you know, I think art has an ability to do that for us, allow us to see things that we otherwise wouldn't see.
Hey, it's Srini. I wanted to tell you about our new online course called Distraction Mastery. In this course, you'll learn exactly how to eliminate time-robbing distractions, master your attention, and get in the zone on command. In under 10 minutes a day, you'll learn a proven, powerful framework for killing distractions and developing unshakable focus based on proven research and experience. These are the exact strategies that I've personally used to write 2 books and hundreds of articles. So, to learn more, visit courses.unmistakablecreative.com. Again, that's courses.unmistakablecreative.com.
I would say. I think the other thing that's really interesting is that the whole meaning of what authority is really changing too, right? Because if somebody says, you know, like this is the thing that I have always kind of abided by is that you should never treat anybody's advice as gospel only guidance.
Yes. Or you're going to get let down.
Yeah. It's so funny because I think one of the things that really struck me from our first conversation, and I remember writing this down somewhere, I may have even written an article about it. I remember you said, eventually I'm going to disappoint you because I'm human. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yes.
Well, I think that makes a really nice segue to actually talk about sort of your backstory and how you've gotten to this point. I think there was, I don't remember the exact line in the book, and this is why I was so annoyed that I couldn't find it this morning, because this line in particular really struck me. But, I know your background. You were an honor student in high school. You came from what sounds like a relatively good family. You weren't headed down the path of trouble. And I don't know if you remember the exact quote I'm talking about, but the question was the very question you posed is, how does somebody like you end up on the path that you did?
Yeah. Yes. I don't remember the exact question, but it was something along those lines. And that is the question. So you're asking me that question, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, I'm not sure. I wish I had that, that insight fully, but I mean, over the years, I'm 9 years in recovery from drug addiction and alcoholism after having lost my children for 2 years. I know you know this, but I was saying it for your listeners. Srini, I think all I can really say about that is that I had these very staunch religious beliefs. I grew up at least partially in the Mormon church, kind of a long story, but I did go every week. My dad and family was not Mormon. My mom was a loose Mormon. I mean, she was LDS, but she was not particularly rigid about a lot of it. And so I had these very firm beliefs in God and morality and the way you're supposed to live. And then I smoked pot for the first time and nothing happened. And I'll tell you, man, I really felt like I had been hoodwinked. I really thought God would do something. I thought he would part the clouds and hit me, or that I would feel something. I didn't even feel anything. And I think that combined with this sense of, I had a lot of fear and a lot of unrest and a lot of feeling separated from the rest of the world. And I couldn't find material relief in my beliefs. Does that make sense? Like I couldn't find My religious beliefs didn't actually help me feel better inside, and alcohol did. And so I think the combination of it as a teenager of feeling like I'd been lied to, like I'd just been sold a giant crock of shit, frankly, combined with this sense of isolation and fear and wanting an actual relief of the way that I felt, it just was a sort of perfect storm. And the first time I drank alcohol, I thought I'd found God. I thought, okay, well, this is what I've been looking for. Cause I put this stuff in my body and I feel better instantly. I feel free. I feel smart. I feel like the future is hopeful and the past makes sense. And I pursued that relief and that feeling, at pretty much any cost, but I was still able to go to college. I was an honor student. I went abroad to Spain. I kind of kept my looking good. But unfortunately alcoholism is a progressive disease and I didn't know I had it. And as you continue drinking, it gets worse. And so by the time I was having problems, I couldn't stop. big problems, right? By the time I really was trying to stop, I couldn't stop. And then I just sort of went downhill from there. But I definitely, you know, I would say, at the risk of sounding a little woo-woo here, I think I went to drugs and alcohol for largely sort of spiritual bankruptcy, a sort of vapid feeling inside of me. I don't know if that sort of a search for meaning, a search for something to make this life meaningful and manageable. Mm-hmm. And I chose the wrong solution.
Yeah.
You know, if I remember correctly from our last conversation, you said that your brother is a doctor who is very devout as a Mormon.
Yeah.
What has been the impact on the relationships in your life with both your mother and your siblings as a byproduct of this? I think the relationship with your kids is obvious, and we'll get into that. But let's talk about the relationship with your mother and your brother as a result of this.
You mean of the book or my alcoholism?
Of your alcoholism. And then we'll talk about the book as well.
Well, you know, I don't come from a family where they, you know, eject people like me. I have a very, very loving family. And they, while they didn't understand what was going on, we have a lot of alcoholism in our family on my father's side. But they did the best they could for me. You know, and now, I mean, they did absolutely everything they could. My brother was living in Virginia when most of this disaster was occurring. He was in medical school in Virginia, and so I was out here in California. But they definitely didn't come at me with religion, knowing that that wouldn't work. I mean, they showed me a lot of love. You know, they tried to do what they could. Mm-hmm. Religion has never been used. They have never used religion as a weapon against me, which I realize is not every family, but that I was lucky enough to have that. Hmm. Did that answer your question?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
So what was the low point? What was the thing that finally caused you to say, okay, this is enough?
Well, you know, you would think it was when my mother showed up one day and took my children. I was not in a condition where I could take care of them. And I had lost my job because I had drug-induced schizophrenia. So I was out of my mind. And so I was unable to hold a job. I was not with my children. And I was desperately trying to get sober, in and out of rehabs, went to a mental institution, couldn't do it. And none of those moments got me sober, which is so bizarre. You would think it would. But the reason it didn't is because alcohol was still working for me, in the sense of I could drink the alcohol and get that relief that I was describing earlier. And unfortunate news for anyone who's listening and still drinking alcoholically, someday alcohol will stop working for you. I'm sure you've all heard about that, right? That like someday the drug stops working and you are left in this horrible rat wheel, just this hamster wheel of chasing something that you used to know, and it never comes back. And you know, Srini, I don't think I'll ever fully understand what happened to me that morning, but I had woken up one morning, it was March 5th, 2009, in my mother's house. I had weaseled my way back in. I was lying, saying I was sober, and I was not. I had managed to get, you know, barely get my job back, so that, but I was on my last legs there because I hadn't been showing up again. And I woke up that morning and I was coming off a 3-day drunk. I was shaking. I was sweating. I was very sick. And something shifted in me internally where I always had a next move, you know, like in the all the other times that I would be trying to fight my alcoholism, I always said, well, as soon as this one thing happens, I'm going to get my act together. You know, as soon as I work my marriage out or I deal with my childhood issues or I get my job back, there was always some maneuver that I had invented that was going to fix my life. And then I wasn't going to have to drink again. And, or, you know, this rehab's going to fix me, or this psychiatrist is going to fix me. And it all failed. And that morning I ran out of ideas. And rather than having a next move or a way to fight it, I gave up the fight and I accepted that I was an alcoholic and that I was not able to drink. And at that moment I became teachable. that was, you know, my ego was crushed enough that people were able to help me. And that was the turning point for me. It was an internal shift. I wasn't even the lowest I had ever been materially. I was actually doing better off than I had in quite a long time. But it was an internal desperation and shift and surrender that took place that forced me to accept that I needed help and that I could not drink and that I needed people to teach me how to live as a sober human being. And I did not expect to be able to stay sober, to be quite honest with you. I never had in the past. Uh-huh. So it was interesting. I mean, I don't know, in your experience, it's often the internal shift that has to take place in order for our lives to change. You know, we can rearrange the externalities till the cows come home and it doesn't do shit, but something shifts inside of us and boom, we're a new person. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Do you remember making any decisions in that moment about how you would behave and choices you would make in your future? Other than not drinking, obviously.
Well, I remember feeling like I always wanted things back in the past before that moment. I always wanted certain outcomes. You know, I wanted my kids back, or I wanted my husband back, or I wanted my job, or I wanted all of these things that were focused on me. And in that moment, you know, to be quite honest, I didn't want anything back. I wanted to be free. I wanted to live freely on this planet, and not be a servant to alcohol. And that was a huge shift. That was something I had never felt before, where the hustle was gone. And it's interesting because the language that we use so often with these things, you know, with things that are struggles that we're having, is often around fighting and battle, you know, fight the battle, fight the war, you know, beat this. And for me, it was more of a surrender when I started finding things changing for me. When I stopped fighting and I accepted the truth was when things started changing for me. And so that was the biggest shift for me, I think, was when I realized that I wasn't chasing something else anymore other than freedom, other than being able to, you know, live a day on the planet, not beholden and tied to this substance.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Wow. So as somebody who has been through rehab, who has had a drug addiction problem, who has had an alcoholism problem, I can't help but ask you about your thoughts on our criminal justice system and the amount of people that are locked up for nonviolent drug offenses.
So what was the question? I'm sorry. Can you ask me?
I'm just wondering, you know, as somebody who's been through this, I am wondering what your opinion is on how many people we have locked up for nonviolent drug offenses.
Oh, it's awful. It's ridiculous. It's utter nonsense. I mean, because it doesn't solve the problem. Right?
We're treating a health problem like a criminal problem, I feel
right.
Like.
You're treating a health problem like a criminal problem. And that doesn't mean that people don't need to be held accountable. But when you have someone, an addict who is, you know, jacked a TV and didn't harm anyone and you give them 10 years in prison, I mean, what are you, especially considering what we do to people when they get out of prison? What we do to their lives. I mean, I have friends who are sober. I have friends who've been sober for 20 years. Who were in prison for heroin, for stealing, you know, for possession or for stealing somebody's stuff. And they've been sober 20 years and are trying to, I mean, I have a friend who was recently, makes me get emotional. She was in and out of prison for years and she grew up in a family with crack addicts. Her mother smoked crack with her for the first time when she was 10. That was the environment she grew up in. She was completely institutionalized in that rotating wheel of in and out of prison. She got sober about 18 years ago and she recently got a job as a mail carrier. And it was 18 years she had to work to try to get a place that would hire her in spite of her criminal past. And I, you know, when you think about that you're marred and you're scarred for life and it doesn't matter if you get sober. It doesn't matter what you do. You still have to check that felon box. And you, I mean, and she was able to appeal to, I mean, the Postal Service hired her, and it was one of the proudest moments she's ever had. I mean, she called me just in tears, and just, and she's been a mail carrier now for years, and it's just fabulous. But it's like, I mean, my God, I mean, this woman turned her complete life around in a miraculous way and was never able to shed those, that, you know, 15, 20 years that she lived that way, despite, even though she grew up in that home, even though she had everything stacked against her. And I think, and I, you know, there's a lot of money to be made in the prison system. I think, you know, people have got to read, you know, Michelle Alexander's book, right? The New Jim Crow, and watch 13th. And I mean, there's a lot of money to be made in keeping these people going in and out of prison, but they're not getting treated. We're treating the symptom and not the cause.
Mm-hmm.
And it's tragic. It's really, really, I mean, there's a, I work out at this, I go volunteer out at this perinatal rehab facility near my house, where it's for pregnant drug addicted women who commit nonviolent drug related crimes. So stealing, possession, et cetera. And sometimes they will be sentenced to, or allowed to go to this rehab facility where they can go with their other children and get prenatal care. They can stay there as long as they want. They get education. They get, you know, formula for the babies. They get a safe birth. And then they are slowly transitioned back into society. But there is one of those institutions in Northern California. One. Hmm. And 20 women in it. So, I mean, come on. Like, yeah, I mean, I don't know. You send them to prison. You take their baby away. Their baby goes into the system. I mean, it's just, it's really sad, Srini. It's really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I watch this and it's like, you know, because a lot of these women, if think about it, you have 3 or 4 kids, and if everybody you know is a drug addict and you're alone, where are you going to put your kids to go get treatment? I mean, most rehabs don't allow children to come with them. So where are these women going to go get help? What are they going to do with their kids? Right?
Yeah.
And then also, you know, the CPS, timeline for child reunification does not align with what we know about addiction and relapse and recidivism. So you're asking these, you're asking drug addicts to completely get their lives together, get housing, get sober, get treated, get health, get a job in 6 months.
Yeah.
Which is just, it takes 3 months. If you're coming off heroin, it takes 3 months before you can really function. I mean, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't mean to go on a rampage, but yes.
No, I asked the question for a reason.
Yeah.
Were you ever scared that you would end up going further and further down this path and ending up in that situation?
Absolutely. And I'm still scared of it. I mean, and honestly, Srini, the only difference between me, my outcomes, and a lot of the outcomes of the people I'm talking about is class and race, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I came from a family that was able to send me to rehab. I came from a family where my mother was able to take my children. I am the color, my skin color is such that I can drive, you know, I can be high or loaded at 2 o'clock in the morning in a bad neighborhood, and the police escort me out of the neighborhood. That literally happened to me.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a neighborhood in, I think it was Richmond, when I was a kid, and I had a bunch of drugs in the backseat of my car, and I, was driving in a, you know, air quote, bad neighborhood. And I thought, for this policeman pulled up behind me, and I thought for sure they were going to pull me over. No. He was escorting me out. Hmm. He escorted me to the freeway, making sure I got out of the neighborhood safely. So, I mean, I got pulled over 3 times for drunk driving. I got off every time. They let me off every time. So I would have had very different outcomes had my socioeconomic and ethnic background been different, you know? And that's not lost on me. That is not lost on me. I mean, my family was able to, you know, we weren't wealthy, but my family was able to, you know, get credit or get funds together to send me to these rehabs where I was able to clean up my act for a while. And consequently, I had very different outcomes than people who don't have those support systems. And that's not lost on me. And that's one of the reasons I spend a lot of time at the mission and out at these facilities trying to kind of repay my debt and try to be of service to people with less, you know, fewer resources than I had.
Mm-hmm.
But it isn't because I was better than them.
Yeah.
Not, you know, I wasn't a better addict. I was positioned differently in society, and then I had different outcomes.
What misperceptions do you think that people have about people like you and people like the ones that we're talking about that are created by media, created by their social programming? Because I'm willing to bet money that
the 20-year-old version of me probably would not, you know, think, oh, this is a person, you're the person I want to talk to and have a conversation on a podcast.
Absolutely. I wouldn't either.
Because I think my perceptions would have been flawed with an incredible amount of judgment for the things that you've done.
Absolutely. And you would be right in those judgments. And those things are all, they're definitely terrible things. But I think the major misconception is that it's simply a matter of willpower and making a decision, right? So, I mean, the addiction is a disease of the pleasure system in the brain, right? Like and I didn't know any of this, obviously, but it essentially rewires our pleasure system to only associate pleasure with this substance. So, I was actually studying with this addiction scientist relatively recently, and he was talking about what happens when you take someone who's technically dry but not far into sobriety, and you put their drug of choice in front of them. If you hook their brains up, and you can, and I'm using very colloquial language because layman's terms, because I don't really know all this terminology. If you put a bag of, you know, cocaine or whiskey in front of me early on, the part of my brain that would light up is the primitive part of the brain that is compulsive and drives instinct. And the part of my brain that would go completely blank is the prefrontal cortex, which is the part of the brain that weighs options and makes decisions and says if this is a good idea or a bad idea. So when their disease has progressed to that point, they're driven to this substance for survival. They can't even see the outcome or the pros and cons, or they can sometimes, but it's very hazy. And so if we come at them, and that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is particularly with mothers. I mean, the narrative that surrounds motherhood and addiction that I've seen mostly in my 9 years of sobriety is, you know, you hear most of a lot of the talks and the blogs and the books as well, even is, you know, I was a terrible, terrible addict. And then I gazed at my newborn's baby toes, or I saw those positive lines on the pregnancy test, and I fell so in love with my child, I never drank again. And I think that is obviously that is a wonderful story, and I love it. And I'm so glad that happened for those people. But when I read that, I would think about the children of addicts who couldn't get sober, mm-hmm. and the conclusion that they would logically draw, you know, if they had a mother who died of this disease or was still in it, and the conclusion would be, I guess my mother didn't love me enough. And so to answer your question in a really long-winded way, I think that's the major misconception that I see, that it is a lack of love or a lack of morality that gets people to this point. And love is not necessarily, you know, once alcoholism has progressed past a certain point, it really doesn't give a shit who you love. I mean, that's not how that works. And it's tragic. And I also am not here to defend the addict at all, or make them a victim, or say that they don't deserve. Obviously they have to take responsibility and they have to have consequences. And none of this is some sort of touchy feely, like, you know, let's all just get in a huddle and, you know, feel sorry for the addict. That's not what I'm saying. But if we actually want outcomes, we're going to have to get past the sort of coming at people with, oh, but don't you love your children? Mm-hmm. Right. Coming at an addicted mother with, but don't you love your kids? That's not doing anything to get her sober. Because of course she loves her kids. That's why she's trying to get sober. Right. Mm-hmm. A lack of love is not necessarily the problem. So that was a long-winded way of answering your question, but I think that, you know, what I wrote with my book is largely me trying to address on some level both the narrative surrounding motherhood, but through the lens of addiction. And I really wanted to look at those two themes together, this sort of, because this juxtaposition of the disgusting nature of addiction and the things that we do, you know, coupled with how deeply we can love our children, brought up a lot of questions for me in my own life, and I was exploring them in this book.
Yeah. Where did the title come from? Because I remember thinking through the title, I'm just happy to be here. And I thought, wow, I mean, it makes sense to me, but I'm wondering how you came up with it.
because it's a sentence I repeat so often in sobriety. It was, you know, when I would have a problem, you know, often going back to this place of gratitude, frankly, and just this sort of humor of it, you know, I'm just happy to be here. Like, yeah, you know, I'm not doing this perfectly, you know, parenting, marriage, job, writing, but at the last, I really am just happy to be here. And that was because it was a sentence that I found myself saying to others and in my own head so often when I would feel like, oh, I should be better. It should be this or it should be that. Kind of going back to that place of just saying, well, shit, you know, I'm just lucky to be here. You know, it's just kind of nice to be alive and have a functioning life, mm-hmm. vaguely functioning, right?
So, you know, I know that you and I were talking about the fact that you have been traveling for book tours and getting to do readings of this book. What have the conversations been like with the people that you've been meeting?
Absolutely breathtaking. I do not use, you know me, I do not use that word lightly. At every stop, there have been one or, you know, two or three people who have just walked up to me and started to talk and just not been able to talk, just started crying. And that's pretty spectacular. Both addicts or families of addicts, but also mothers who have just said, you know, I see myself so clearly in this work. And that, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, that's why we do this work, right? I mean, to be seen and to have other people see us and to, I mean, to have other people see themselves in us, that, you know, me talking to the humanity in you and that having that connection, I mean, that's why I write. And so to go around the country and the West Coast mostly, and, see that that's actually happening, my work is hitting people kind of in that deep truth and their bones. That's, you know, that's why I wrote it. And I think that's why we do this work. It's incredibly rewarding and incredibly humbling, you know? And it's an honor. Yeah. It's really blown me away, honestly. Yeah. And the messages too, a lot of emails and, Facebook messages and comments that have really taken my breath away.
You know, it's interesting because I think that really makes a nice segue to talking about what you and I were talking about before we hit record here, about this notion that you've created something with a great deal of emotional resonance. And at the same time, you have to kind of ignore the desire for it to be commercially successful.
Oh, God, it's so fucking hard. I know, you know. Yeah, it's this incredible dissonance that I think a lot of authors feel. You know, and I was reflecting on this the other day at a reading that I think sometimes we choose our work and sometimes our work chooses us. And this book definitely chose me. It was not a book I had envisioned writing. It was the book I wrote. It was the book that came out of me. Wow, that was sounded like birth. And, you know, frankly, I was a little terrified and low key disappointed when I was like, oh, shit, I'm writing this book. Oh, no, because I really could have written a book that was more in line with my blog that was, you know, comedy or, you know, really, really, really funny. I mean, there's a lot of dark humor in the book, but I mean, of course, because I can't be any other way. But, you know, I could have written a sort of tongue in cheek parenting guide or something sort of more mainstream that really, I think, would have. That probably would have been more commercially successful, although I have no complaints with how this book is doing, and I'm incredibly flattered and honored for all of that. You know, you definitely there's a moment that where you go, okay, I could definitely align with what's mainstream and what's probably the surefire thing, you know, or I can take this riskier path and write something that's a little less universally accessible, or it's definitely going to get me hate mail. And that dissonance of trying to do your art while also trying to feed your family is a tough one. You know, every decision with the publisher, I felt like I was, and they were wonderful, but I felt, you know, this pull of, do I go with my gut or do I go with what's more marketable, right? Do I go with me or do I go with what's gonna sell? And finding myself stuck in this place of being grateful for what we just talked about, these people coming to me and saying, oh my goodness, you know, thank you so much for writing this. And then the next day I'm shifted into complete terror because I'm not selling enough books. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we stay focused in that place? I mean, how do we stay centered in why are we doing our work? What brings my work? You know, what makes this work meaningful? Is it analytics and data and numbers, or is it the actual work itself and the connection with people? And going back and forth between those two realities is absolutely exhausting. And I had no idea it was going to be like this.
Well, as I was telling you, I think that for me, I am wrestling with that dissonance in a way that I never have before, because the very message of my book is the antithesis of metrics and measurements, and everything we're doing is centered around what are we going to do to make this commercially successful?
Oh my God. Yeah.
So like yeah. When you have a message in the book that says this is not the way to approach it, right. And that's what you're doing the whole time, there is very much a lot of dissonance and bizarre paradoxes at play.
Right. And you're like, and there's this sense of, you know, who am I? What am I doing? I mean, but also, as we talked about, you want your work in front of people, yeah. Right? I mean, why? We don't want to write in a vacuum. So how do we get the work in front of people? Well, we have to play the game. Mm-hmm. But can we play the game without losing ourselves? You know, can we play the game without losing our integrity, our sense of, you know, disruption and wanting to resist a little bit? You know, the everything we talked about, that super mainstream kind of the resist those narratives, which your book is clearly going to do as you're talking about it. But yeah, how do we be in the system and disrupt the system at the same time? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a lot.
Wow. Wow.
I've read a lot of, you know, I think Margaret Atwood wrote an essay in one of her books that I'm not going to be able to recall, her book on writing where she talks about this exact thing. And James Baldwin wrote an essay called The Artist's Search for Integrity or something along those lines, where they were both addressing sort of what your first commercial success, you know, whether it's huge or, you know, relatively small, or relatively big, what that does to you as an artist. And that's been helpful to look at, you know, that path. Not that I'm anywhere near either one of them, obviously, but just listening to reading other artists talk about that exact dissonance and how to go back and forth with that.
Wow. Wow. Well, this has been really, really amazing, as I kind of expected it would be. I mean, I didn't know if we'd be able to top our last two conversations, but I am really, really grateful that you have, shared all this. So I want to finish with my last question, and I'm really interested to see how you'll answer this after having finished a book and 2 years later. What do you think it is that makes somebody or something unmistakable?
I think it's the people who are willing to say the way they see it at whatever cost, for better or worse. And the longer I am in this, in the internet world and saturated with the fake news and the so many people with this incredible polished narrative of, you know, self-empowerment or the entrepreneurialism, you know, repeating the same things over and over and over in every narrative, you know. And so I maintain that the unmistakable people are the ones who just fucking say something else, whether they're right or wrong. And that's a huge part of this, right? Is that as soon as we speak up, we risk being wrong. We risk failing and we risk being wrong. And a lot of the people who are unmistakable, I would say, are wrong. You know, we don't align, but are they unmistakable? Absolutely. Because they have planted themselves firmly on the ground and they're willing to speak. And I think that that's all we really have, you know, when everything else is taken away and all the bullshit and all the fear and all the commercial success and money and this, it gets back to, am I speaking the truth as I see it? Hmm. And if we can look at ourselves and answer yes, I think we have a pretty solid chance of being on an unmistakable path.
Wow. Well, I think that makes a really fitting and beautiful end to our conversation. Where can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, I have my blog, Renegade Mothering, which is all over. It's renegademothering.com. It's on Facebook, Twitter, everywhere, Instagram. And my book, I'm Just Happy to Be Here, was published May 1st, 2018, and it's available everywhere.
Awesome. And for everybody listening, we will wrap the show with that. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Unmistakable Creative Podcast. While you were listening, were there any moments you found fascinating, inspiring, instructive, maybe even heartwarming? Can you think of anyone, a friend or a family member who would appreciate this moment? If so, take a second and share today's episode with that one person, because good ideas and messages are meant to be shared.